Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. Dr. Tysel Phillips of City of Hope spoke with Cancer Network ahead of the FDA accelerated approval of epcoritamab in relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma to discuss how this agent may impact the treatment paradigm. The conversation also focused on the potential advancement of bispecific antibodies and how they may expand access to treatment as they continue to see growing use in community settings. First, what might the potential FDA approval of epcoritamab in relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma mean for this patient population?
The biggest impact will be probably in centers who've picked quote-unquote one bispecific to keep on their formulary. Obviously, with epcoritamab's approval already in large cell lymphoma, it does allow them just to keep one bispecific agent on formulary and doesn't require them to have two in this situation. And current, if they have a bispecific for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and a bispecific for follicular lymphoma, it will require them to have either epcoritamab, glofitamab for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and then mosunetuzumab for follicular lymphoma. So this potentially, again, just allows for ease of use in that situation. Less sort of difficulties with staff, infusion nurses, et cetera, with dealing with different bispecifics, and obviously more comfortability with dealing with one drug, which in the long term always is better for the patients just because easier to manage toxicity that may come from this, and obviously more familiarity with the step-up dosing for epcoritamab, which is different from what we have with mosunetuzumab and glofitamab, and also some of the side effects that come from that, like cytokine release syndrome and ICANS, which is the neurological toxicity that can be associated with this. Again, the timing of all those events are different with those drugs. So again, just allow some more familiarity with that and potentially hopefully cheaper prices as these move into the outpatient setting.
I see. And supporting data for the application in pursuit of approval in this indication came from the EPCOR NHL-1 trial. How promising do the data look in support of the potential approval in your eyes?
Yeah, I mean, the data is still a bit immature compared to some of what we see with maybe the CAR-T drugs and even mosunetuzumab. So the duration of response is still something that is to be determined, as I'm sure that data is still maturing. I mean, I think overall, efficacy-wise, meaning the overall response rate, complete response rate, looks very similar to what we see with mosunetuzumab. So again, in that aspect, there's no major differences between the two drugs. The cytokine release syndrome or CRS events appear to be a little bit less than what we saw with large cell lymphoma, but not drastically different. So I think the big takeaway, one is efficacy-wise, I think it's still to be determined how effective and durable this will be. Given that, you know, epcoritamab appears to be a more effective drug on large cell lymphoma than mosunetuzumab, you would hope that that would translate into longer responses in follicular lymphoma, especially given, you know, some of the other aspects of the drug, which is, you know, treatment to progression, which is a little bit different from mosunetuzumab. And the cytokine release rates seem to be a bit higher with epcoritamab than what we saw with mosunetuzumab. So in order to justify that, you would obviously want to hope for a longer duration of response with this drug.
And with this approval, is there any unmet need that epcoritamab would help to reduce?
Again, as we try to transition these bispecifics into the community setting, I think having these drugs available and allows for patients who, you know, can't get to CAR-T or we can't get to other academic centers for clinical trials, this provides them a more effective option, especially with the loss of the PI3 kinase inhibitors in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. So when these patients fail chemotherapy and they may fail lenalidomide, there's a bit of a void there as of right now as far as agent that could provide some durability of response. So having this fill that void and being able to be off the shelf and readily available for patients who, again, who live in situations where they can't get access to CAR-T or can't get to a major academic center, these drugs could bridge that gap and give these patients adequate response, durability, and after dealing with step-up dosing, safety-wise, so these drugs are are quite promising, especially as compared to of the now defunct delta inhibitors of chemotherapy, some of these other drugs that may be coming down the line.
I know you kind of hinted at this in some of your previous answers, but personally, how would you implement this treatment into your own clinical practice?
I think this is a very effective therapy that we can use in a third line setting, or even in those patients who may have progression of disease after the 24 months. So these early progressing patients tend to have poor outcomes, especially when given more cytotoxic agents like chemotherapy. So ideally, this treatment does not appear to be impacted by that sort of prognostic factor. So it does allow utilization in that situation. And so if patients are to get lenalidomide and rituximab in the frontline setting, again, this allows, use of this drug after that, or again, in the third line setting where, again, as of right now, there's really just one real agent, tazemetostat, that has the current approval as of right now. It allows for, a more effective therapy than what we see with tazemetostat, and a more durable response than what we see with tazemetostat.
You mentioned CRS earlier as one of the prominent toxicities in the trial, but are there any other toxicities associated with the agent that might stand out to you?
Sure. I mean, besides the CRS, it's the immune effector cell neurological syndrome, which we call ICANS. That's obviously one thing that we always keep an eye on. The rates of those are much less with the bispecifics than we will see with CAR T, which is the chimeric antigen receptor therapy. But infections are the other thing that we will obviously have to keep an eye on because of how bispecifics work. They will treat the malignant and the normal B cell. And without B cells, obviously, you're more prone to viral infections. The good news, obviously, is that the COVID-19 pandemic, we've come a long way, and those infections are much readily able to be managed and treated. But we're not having nearly as many fatalities as we have in the early parts of the pandemic. But keeping an eye on patients' immunoglobulin levels and repleting those if necessary to prevent more recurrent viral infections is important. And, as we move along with epcoritamab, obviously, as I mentioned before, it's a treatment to progression or intolerance. Obviously, as hopefully we get more information, we'll be able to determine whether that's necessary or whether this drug can be stopped a bit earlier than what it's currently sort of slated for right now. Just because, obviously, anytime we constantly keep patients on treatment, you do run the risk of other things that may come up that we may not anticipate later down the line. But at least in the short term, I would say infection. ICANS and, as I mentioned, CRS are the biggest things to be concerned about with this type of treatment, which is a little bit different from what we see with chemotherapy, where you get the nausea, the vomiting, the bacterial infections, and obviously the secondary malignancies that come along with it.
Great breakdown of that. Thank you. Are there any other plans to further research epcoritamab in this patient population, or perhaps other types of cancers?
With the bispecifics, I like to say they have a lot of potential for upward mobility. So I would readily anticipate that these will be explored in the frontline setting. Epcoritamab, as well as the other bispecifics, are already being explored in the second line setting in combination with lenalidomide. I'm sure that combination as a single agent and probably with lenalidomide will be explored in untreated or newly diagnosed patients. And we're sort of seeing this same phenomenon in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which is the most common lymphoma. Epcoritamab, glofitamab, all and odronextamab, all being studied in the frontline setting in that patient population. Epcoritamab is being studied in mantle cell lymphoma. There's also a study with looking at this drug in Richter's transformation, which is a CLL patient that develops a large cell lymphoma transformation. So there are multiple sort of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma subsets that are being explored with epcoritamab and the bispecifics in general. Because of their combinability with other agents, I would anticipate we'll likely see them combined with other drugs of an earlier lines of therapy than what the current FDA approvals will say at this current time.
I know you highlighted this upward mobility of these bispecific agents, so sort of as a bonus question, are there any other developments in the lymphoma field or perhaps hematology oncology as a whole that have the potential to impact clinical practice?
So, I mean, besides the bispecifics, obviously the major sort of other treatment has been CAR T. CAR T has really just been hampered probably logistically by just being fixed at certain centers because obviously you can't just go to your corner oncologist and get a CAR T cell therapy. So That has sort of limited its applicability. But overall, especially in large cell lymphoma, and even some recent updates in follicular lymphoma have shown that this one-time treatment has significant durability, and at least in large cell lymphoma, the potential to cure patients. As we move along, they are developing sort of dual targeting CAR Ts, armored CAR Ts, and other CAR Ts to sort of improve those therapies. What we have seen before is anything that sort of impacts or can be done with a CAR T cell therapy will also can be replicated with a bispecific. So I think as we move along, we'll start to see dual targeting bispecifics, meaning they'll target CD20 plus something else in addition to pulling in the T cells. A few of those are already in clinical practice. I'm assuming we'll start seeing more and more of those come out, especially as it at least some of the resistance we're seeing to some of these CD20 bispecifics has lost the CD20 receptor. Obviously, it's much harder for cancer cells to lose two targets versus one. I think as we move forward in the future, we'll start seeing more and more of these sort of trispecifics, as they want to call it, as they look for different targets to try to overcome some of the resistance that we see in the cancer cells.
Great, thank you. Those were all the questions that I had for you. Was there anything else that you wanted to discuss or highlight?
No, I think your question's pretty much covered the biggest aspects of it. Like I said, at least, well, I guess one thing with the bispecifics, I think for patients, as you know, community oncologists get more and more comfortable with these drugs and have the structure to set up to safely administer these drugs for the first month where, you know, most of the complications happen. I think more and more patients will be able to be treated with these drugs, and which will be a great benefit based on what we've seen in early response rates for these drugs. So it'll be a big benefit for the patient population in the long term as more community settings sort of implement these drugs into the clinical practice.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.